is available online at cfrc.ca or on Instagram at CFRC Prison Radio. We look forward to receiving your messages and sharing them over the airwaves.
Have you experienced sexual harassment in the workplace? Do you have questions about your rights? Unfortunately, sexual harassment at work continues to affect many people in Ontario. Sexual harassment can occur in many ways, from unwanted sexual comments and innuendo to sexual images on a phone or group chat to physical contact or demands for dates. It can happen at work, online, or on social media, during training, or at office parties. It can involve your boss, a coworker, or other staff. No matter what, sexual harassment at work is wrong. Ontario Legal Clinics are here to help. Know your rights. Call 1-833-677-5146 for free confidential legal advice or visit shapeyourworkplace.ca for more information.
Hi, my name is Genevieve and I'll be hosting Peace, Love and Jenny on CFRC 101.9 FM on Saturday evenings at 8 p.m. We'll be exploring everything from pop and soul to funk, jazz, and even a touch of hip-hop. Music that spans decades but all connects through good vibes, peace and love, and of course, a little bit of me, Jenny. See you there!
Good morning. It is 11 a.m. on Friday, February 13th, and you're tuned in to CFRC 101.9 FM, broadcasting from Lower Carruthers Hall on Queen's Campus in Kingston, Ontario. I'm CFRC's broadcast journalist, Christina Laurie, and this is Kingston Currents. CFRC's news programming is brought to you by the generous support of the Community Radio Fund of Canada, under the Local Journalism Initiative, Queen's University Career Services, and the Screening Room at screeningroomkingston.com. In today's episode, we'll be diving into some updates from last week's City Council meeting, the Coldest Night of the Year event coming up next weekend in support of Lionhearts, the extension of winter festivities downtown, and a unique collaboration between the Canadian Museum of Healthcare and the Kingston Cinema Society. Without further delay, let's get into it. On Saturday, February 28th, Kingstonians will be braving the cold to help provide relief to those who need it most. Coldest Night of the Year is a nationwide fundraising walk, with 100% of proceeds going to local charities supporting those experiencing hurt, hunger, and homelessness. Since 2011, the Coldest Night of the Year has raised over $75 million across Canada in 190 communities. In Kingston, the fundraiser supports Lionhearts, which is aiming to raise $65,000 this year, up from last year's total of nearly $50,000 as need continues to rise. I spoke with Lionheart CEO Travis Blackmore about how this year compares to past walks, the growing need for support, and what Kingstonians can expect this year. I was wondering if you could give us some context walking into this year. What looks different this year in terms of need, urgency, and demand for Lionheart services?
Yeah, unfortunately, with today's climate and the way things are, the need has never been greater in the community. The amount of folks that are victim of food insecurity is only growing, unfortunately. So that makes us feel at least fortunate that Lionhearts is able to help in this regard, and we're honored to be able to do so. But we need help from folks in the community. It's often said it takes a village, and it sure does. It takes all of us, including our partners that donate to us, and then those frontline agencies that we do distribution and food, culinary and meals for. Yeah, it all ties together to bring together a community to make a difference. And Coldest Night is one of those fundraising moments for us in the year that's very important. Gets us outside, gets us moving together as a community, as a group, to raise awareness, but also to raise funds to continue making that difference throughout the rest of the year.
Mm-hmm. And you mentioned there, need has never been greater, both in terms of immediate pressures and projects in the works. What kind of things will these funds raised this year be going towards?
For sure. Well, when we do our food rescue, it is quite an operation, and it's no small task. So a lot will go toward helping move those trucks and move those vehicles. Last year, in the first 6 months, Lionheart's gathered and distributed over $10.5 million worth of goods and got that, made sure that that food was put to use in the community, making nutritious meals and also being provided to agencies to make meals as well. There's a number of other projects that Lionheart's has, including our supportive housing, but also our mobile markets for those that are elderly and living in food deserts, as well as student food boxes. There's a number of things that Lionheart's does in the community, and this will all go to reinforce that and help us in 2026.
Mm-hmm. And Lionheart's is already at 49% of its $65,000 goal, a bit of a higher goal than last year. How are you feeling so far with this early momentum?
Honestly, Kingston is one of those generous cities. There's a bunch of generous people living there. So the fact that we're about to hit that 50% mark is so encouraging. It's usually always right at the last couple of days that you get really close to that goal, because that's just the nature of fundraising. But other things like coming to the end of the month and awareness and all the things that we're grateful for, even folks like you helping us get the word out there to those and just reminding them that they can make a difference. There's still time to sign up a team or join a team or contribute to a team, or just even hitting that share button is a big, big help. And so honestly, I'm grateful to the Kingston community and how they rally behind us each and every year.
Mm-hmm. And going into this year, I was wondering if you could share just a few of the ways that folks can contribute and offer any last words of encouragement to get the community out on the 28th.
Yeah, of course. So if you are to go to CNOY, coldest night of the year, CNOY.org, and search Kingston, you'll see Lionheart's right there. You can click inside the website to make your donation. If you have a friend that's walking, you can contribute to their walk. And I would challenge you, if you own a business, sign up a team, represent your business, get out there, create awareness, rally folks behind you. If you're an individual, you can still start your own team. Get together some colleagues or people from your circle of life that you walk with, you can still make a difference. If you go to our Facebook or Instagram or our X-Job, you can click the share button. And again, it's all about creating that awareness. You never know who is in your circle that will feel moved to contribute in a meaningful way. And all of these things add up to making Coldest Night of the Year a success.
I feel like every year we hear about just the vibe on the day and how inspiring it is and hopeful. I was wondering if you could just speak to that and what folks can expect this year in alignment with past years.
Oh, yeah. I mean, when we kick off, we like to motivate folks and really get across our appreciation for them setting aside the time and wanting to make a difference in their community. The mayor will be there to give some words to the community. We'll all rally together and begin the walk halfway through. And our amazing sponsor, Starbucks, will provide hot and cold drinks again. They've always been a huge support for us in this community, so massive hats off to Starbucks. And then we'll again return back to our host venue, which is Kingston Gospel Temple, and there'll be hot food, refreshments, and also live music this year with Andrew Van Horn and the Celtic Kitchen Party. So we like to have a good time. I mean, it's heavy subject matter, making a difference, food insecurity, people struggling. But, you know, in the true Canadian spirit, we can have fun while we try to take care of those that might be struggling. You know, that's what the Canadian spirit is all about.
Once again, that was Lionheart CEO Travis Blackmore on Coldest Night of the Year 2026, taking place on Saturday, February 28th. This year's Kingston Walk will begin at the Kingston Gospel Temple at 2295 Princess Street and finish at the Indigo Starbucks at the Cataraqui Center. Walkers will travel up to 5 kilometers, beginning shortly after 5 p.m. Coldest Night of the Year is family-friendly and open to people of all ages and abilities, with route options designed to be accessible and welcoming. Once again, you can visit CNOY.org for more information. After a motion that passed unanimously at Council's last meeting, the city is looking to make improvements to the public consultation process related to new supportive and emergency housing solutions. This motion, brought forward by Councillor Lisa Osanek, is the result of community feedback regarding the approach to engagement on 3 recent supportive housing sites. One Kingston resident that lives near one of the recent sites, Joe Grattan, spoke to the issue before council.
The last time I stood here, I was hopeful I would be heard. Today, I'm simply frustrated. I'm here today to speak in support of the motion regarding consultation and public engagement on supportive and emergency housing. To date, this process has been a disaster, and it's clear changes are required. Residents have been stonewalled when seeking basic information. We raise legitimate questions about site selection, operational impacts, zoning compliance, program effectiveness, and neighborhood compatibility. We were told our concerns were unfounded, yet no evidence has been provided to support these claims or address the issues we raised. Meaningful consultation must happen before locations are announced and in the neighborhoods being impacted. Communication must be exhaustive and proactive. Reports buried in council agendas are not engagement. Announcing a finalized location and then dismissing criticism as NIMBYism is not engagement.
Councillor Lisa Osanek and seconder Councillor Gregory Ridge explained the intention behind the motion before council.
This motion is to look for improvement in the process. I'll be really interested to see how, like, what the comparison is of how we're doing it compared to other cities. I know that we're not the only city that is buying housing in neighborhoods for supportive housing. So I'll be really interested to see how that comparison comes out. Also, if it is decided that we're allowed under a human rights-based approach to continue to, give notification to neighbors, doing the flyers in the mailboxes, then the process that comes back to us, it is going to have to be that we do that notification on a Monday, not on a Friday, and not during the last 2 weeks of December. Even if that means that a house closes during the last 2 weeks of December, we wait until January on a Monday to give that notification, just to really keep that transparency.
This issue about communications, especially with the sensitive nature of the supports or the emergency services that are being provided in the neighborhood, is one that I've heard many times from constituents. And I think that this is an iterative process. This is something where we learn from what we've done, and then we improve the process over and over again so that there's an acceptable standard operating procedure that we can move forward with. So I'm happy to support this. I'm happy to work towards an ideal solution or an ideal operation.
In the current process for supportive and emergency housing sites, properties are acquired in closed session, later released publicly through door drops and the creation of a Get Involved Kingston page, and discussed in community meetings. Proposed improvements include, but are not limited to, consideration of the timing and methods for information sharing with near neighbors, the scale and format of engagement meetings, confirmation of the role of the site operators in these engagements, and the processes for receiving, responding to, and reporting back on community concerns. Many councillors expressed their agreement with the need for improvements and frustration on how the process has been going with recent sites, including Councillor Ryan Bohm.
Fear grows without the lack of information. So I'm going to just paint a little story on this. So closed session, you're essentially sworn to secrecy. You have information, you cannot make it public, or you are in breach of your code of conduct and there will be an investigation, and we know how that plays out. So you'll have information as a counselor at times that you're unable to share with the public. That can be quite frustrating, especially when somebody from the public reaches out to you and says, hey, what do you know about this address? And it's the exact address that you can't share and it's confidential, and you're going because it's being discussed at the local gym. Well, this isn't just vague. It might be in this area of the district. This address was known long beforehand, before the city had any official statement, and you're sitting there going, oh dear. What do you do at that point? So you basically kind of try to get information out as best as possible. And so to say that we can do things better, we have to do things better. That information has to be put out there. We tend to do things, unfortunately, with many things lately, in a very reactive role when it comes to communications. And it's very frustrating. You put information out, you make a decision, you call something engagement that's not really engagement, and then you provide a bunch of information after the fact. People are rightly upset, and they have a right to be. We need to do better with our communication. Supportive housing can be successful, but we also need to set it up to be successful and not create these additional challenges for ourselves and actually have the public realize this is a successful model. We shouldn't have to convince them. They should already know because we've done the legwork ahead of time.
Councillor Brandon Tozzo noted that while the process will be improved, the city's process of acquiring properties in closed session will likely not change, and there is still friction beyond communications to be addressed.
Our process of purchasing houses in closed session is likely not going to change to this. I'm going to say just a few quiet things loud, and I think it's worth noting where we get our direction from as a council for the policy that we give to staff. We get our direction from the public. So when we run for election, we knock on doors and we hear from thousands of people who give us direction of where they want the city of Kingston to go. And you know, the number one thing I heard at the doors when I was knocking? Homelessness and housing. So I think it's worth knowing that the policies that we put forward, and this becomes a challenge every time we deal with shelter-related issues or housing-related issues or density-related issues, is the public is kind of getting what they're asking for when we put these policies forward. So for as far as what the policies that we're putting forward, I fully agree that we can communicate things better, but we are delivering what you told us to do when we ran for election in 2022. And when we knock on doors later this year, we will deliver what you tell us to do. If you're asking for us to solve homelessness, we're going to throw everything we possibly can to solve homelessness, Your Worship. If you're asking us we need more housing, you're going to get housing. We listen to the public and we are the most local, accessible levels of government. So I would just say to the public, you're getting what you're asking for. We can certainly do this better. We can work with neighbors. But if this is your top priorities at the door, you know, kind of be careful what you wish for.
Recommendations to improve this process will be brought to council by July 2026. With unanimous support from council, the city will be moving forward with the development of a student housing strategy. According to the motion, the lack of coordinated student housing framework has increased pressure on the rental market, limiting the availability of long-term housing for families, seniors, and workers. A student housing strategy would support the development of purpose-built housing to ease this pressure, improve neighborhood stability, and provide greater certainty for land use, infrastructure planning, and alignment with post-secondary institutions. Nick Graham, board member of the Sydenham District Association, spoke before council on behalf of five neighborhood organizations representing Kingston's inner districts.
We have talked with many residents who are deeply worried about the erosion of established neighborhoods and the need to better provide accommodation for students. Permanent residents are particularly concerned about the studentification of downtown neighborhoods. Equally importantly, we have heard from student representatives expressing the urgent need for quality housing that is affordable, safe, and close to campus. Further, developers deserve clarity around the design and location of proposed student-focused housing projects that are critical to addressing Kingston's housing crisis. The status quo can only result in continued conversion of family neighborhoods into student neighborhoods, shortage of quality student housing for students living close to campus, reduced availability of affordable housing for Kingstonians, and degradation of property standards in affected neighborhoods. A student housing strategy will help address these problems, leading to improved student housing, protection of neighborhoods, and faster and lower risk opportunities for developers.
The motion was brought forward by Councillor Connie Glenn.
So I'm bringing this motion forward because student housing has become a citywide affordability issue. The students are facing challenges as well as the broader community. Let's face it, we are a post-secondary city when we look at the number of students that actually come here every year. The students are a vital part of the city, of the economy, the community, but also of our future. And the need for student housing has grown without a very clear, coordinated strategy, and we're feeling the impacts. Right now, we have one housing market that's trying to meet a very broad variety of housing needs. Students, seniors, families, affordable housing, social housing. We're trying to fill all kinds of gaps. It's like, you know, putting our fingers in the proverbial dam and hoping that we can stop this. But without clear direction, we've seen what the outcomes are. Studentification, rising community tension. We're talking about this on a regular basis. A loss of family neighborhoods, rising rents, poorer living conditions. A student housing strategy will help prevent those outcomes from continuing. Now, I want a moment to address the blame game that's often gone on around this issue. We've seen it, heard it, maybe even been a part of it. But students didn't create the housing shortage. Neighborhoods and institutions didn't cause the market pressures. This is a system issue, not a people problem. So the system needs to be addressed, and that's why strategy is important.
Post-secondary students attending Queen's University, St. Lawrence College, and the Royal Military College make up 20% of Kingston's population. Other municipalities with significant post-secondary populations, including Toronto, Waterloo, and Niagara Region, have adopted student housing strategies or policies within their official plans to guide development, protect neighborhoods, and support housing affordability. Councillors expressed their agreement with the move, including Councillors Vincent Shinani and Don Amos, who both have significant student populations in their neighborhoods.
I'm surrounded with students where I live, pretty much. So, like, the line keeps moving closer and closer. So my street is the line now, and then it kind of spreads out a little bit. And I've heard from a lot of neighbors. They don't mind having student neighbors, but it's becoming where they're a house with, like, you know, at least 10 students or more. And then there's cars everywhere on the street, and And talking to a lot of these students is they couldn't find somewhere close to the university to live. So I think that this is an important plan to have. I think having this plan and strategy can really focus on where can we build for students and where is appropriate and where do the students want to be. And I think this is a really important plan, and I think it'll, in the long run, it'll guide our housing strategy in a better way.
This type of housing strategy is greatly needed, purposeful built. We've seen a number of the neighborhoods, specifically Polson Park, Calvin, and even the Village, have student pressures be brought upon it. And I think this is a good step in the direction.
According to the motion, the student housing strategy will include consideration of zoning tools, density permissions, and build form guidelines specific to student housing, strategies to establish partnerships with institutions and the private sector to reduce pressure on the traditional rental market and enhance overall housing affordability, measures to support neighborhood compatibility, safety, and infrastructure capacity, and alignment with the city's broader housing affordability and climate objectives. The motion also directs staff to develop a strategy which, quote, only regulates the use of land, not its residents. Councillor Gregory Ridge, while also supportive of the motion, noted that the city will have to proceed with caution, and the municipality will not be able to fully resolve the issues.
This meeting in general, like speaking about this motion, but also this meeting in general, has been very interesting because we have in many ways been hemming around this idea of people zoning, right, which is in violation of the Ontario Human Rights Code. And so we have to be very careful in our conversations about this and about notifications to communities about supportive housing. Like, these are all actually very similar in terms of what issue it is. And so while I am in support of this, I want to express that I think in our conversations about this, both this evening and in the future, that we have to be very careful about the language and the tact that we take with regards to this and other pieces. And so that's something that I'll be thinking about in the future, because students are representative here. And I think at the end of the day, if we're talking about economics, through your worship, we're all at the end result of financialization of the housing market, where people who are seeking profit because they own property are finding the best avenue forward for that, which happens to be higher turnover, which happens to be students. And that's what's driving this ultimately. And so I don't think a municipality in its entirety has a solution for this, but I think that we should try to address this however we can.
According to Councillor Glenn, Queen's University is also in the process of speaking with a consultant about what they can do to contribute. Glenn also noted her hope for a shift in attitude on this topic.
The call for a student housing strategy has garnered both broad and uncommon alignment. It's supported by 5 neighborhood associations, 5 out of 12. That's pretty good. We're almost at 50% of neighborhoods coming on board and saying, we want this. We've also got the support of Queen's University and student representatives. They're working together, and the great thing about it is they're holding hands, and when you're holding hands, you can't point fingers. So I think this is a huge step forward.
Staff will report back to Council in Q2 of 2026 with a proposed scope, including cost and estimated timing for the completion of a student housing strategy.
I think this is a positive step forward to addressing what has been a massive challenge in this city. I'm looking forward to seeing the official plan and having this accompany it in a way that will move us forward.
At their last meeting, Council voted to defer a decision on allocating up to $350,000 for events marking the anniversary of the Tragically Hip's final concert. 2026 marks the 10th anniversary of the Tragically Hip's final concert, held in Kingston on August 20th, 2016 at the Rogers K-Rock Center. The original motion would have approved funding from the city's working fund reserve to support programming, events, and activations tied to the anniversary. However, council and residents alike have expressed concerns about the size and scope of the proposed funding. Councillor Wendy Steven brought forward a deferral which would delay the decision until March of 2026, directing staff to return with more detailed information about the planned events and how the funds would be used.
The Tragically Hip are a Kingston band, and the celebration of the 10th anniversary of the final concert should be an exciting and celebratory opportunity for the community to come together and to look forward to the events and programming that is yet to come. In closed session, Council had the benefit of learning more about the still confidential events and programs that are currently being planned for here in Kingston. Staff have indicated they're not able to discuss activation details as negotiations are still ongoing. And while there's some risk to approving the funding, or sorry, to not approving the funding this evening, but that risk really needs to be balanced with council and community's ability to better understand how this requested money will be used ahead of the funding approval. So this motion will hopefully allow staff to return with additional information that can allow council and community to consider this opportunity with greater insight into what this investment will bring to Kingston.
Several councillors voiced their support for the deferral, saying more clarity is needed before committing public funds.
Yet again, I find myself in an unusual position where I'm agreeing with a motion to defer. I think that there is a lot of uncertainty with regards to what this money is being used for. I certainly have heard considerably from the community about some of the inappropriateness that this money is being spent, considering that there are other really important issues in the community, especially related to food insecurity and housing and homelessness. My hope is that when we do defer this motion, I agree that I think it's appropriate that we get the public some more information, that it can be clarified at that time. So I'm hoping for staff to come back and just provide some more assurances to the community that this money is being well spent, and also some idea of where the money, this $350,000 is going.
I received a number of emails and concerns from my constituents about the amount that was being used. It appeared to be a slightly open check with the inability for council to show their governance and due diligence and what an understanding publicly of what the 350 was being used for. So I am prepared to support the deferral, knowing that I had a large amount or grave amount of concerns with the original motion.
I think the optics of this are very hard to swallow, especially with the current climate out there. So I'll vote in favor of the deferral and hoping that we can understand and maybe reset the narrative on the benefits that go with this. But without that, I don't think this is something that I could support down the road. But willing to see what a deferral could bring to change sort of how this is perceived in the public, which I think we're all getting emails on. I know I sure did.
Councillor Jeff McLaren took a stronger position, arguing the funding should be voted down outright.
I won't be supporting this because I don't support spending this kind of public money on a party. This is a bad use of public funds, regardless if they come from property taxpayers or from other taxpayers. They're all the same. So I wouldn't be supporting this in the future, and I think we should vote it down now.
In the end, council voted to defer the motion, with all councillors in favor except Councillor McLaren. Staff are expected to return to council with additional details ahead of the March 2026 discussion. Council has unanimously approved a motion to pause parking enforcement during Remembrance Day ceremonies. The motion, brought forward by Councillor Ryan Boehm and seconded by Councillor Brandon Tozzo, directs staff to suspend all parking enforcement annually on November 11th between 10 a.m. and noon. The pause is intended to prevent parking tickets from discouraging or inconveniencing those gathering to observe the day. The motion notes the city's strong military history, making it especially important to remove barriers for residents attending ceremonies. Councillor Boehm explained the intent behind the motion.
We are a military city. This is something that we can do. After this past Remembrance Day, I've got numerous sort of notices of people who were 1 or 2 minutes late getting back to their vehicle and had a parking ticket from attending a ceremony. And it's kind of one of those frustrating things where I feel like this is something quite simple that we can do to just pause these tickets during that time frame to recognize the fact that the freedoms and the, you know, liberties we enjoy today and the sacrifices that were paid for them. We definitely want to increase attendance at these ceremonies and make sure that people are not having this, you know, hassle or fear, and they're truly involved and engaged at those ceremonies and not worrying about, you know, running back through whatever conditions present themselves to try to avoid a, you know, 2 minute late parking ticket. So that's essentially the cusp of this. And I hope we can be unanimous on this.
The motion also specifies that the enforcement pause applies only to Remembrance Day and will not be extended to other events. This change will take effect beginning this year. Before we get into more local news, I'm going to turn to your weather and traffic report for this morning with CFRC's Jesse Bell.
This is your Environment Canada weather report for the Kingston region. Friday, February 13th, daytime high of -5, actually feeling right around zero in the sunshine. Saturday, February 14th, Valentine's Day, daytime high of -2, feeling closer to -11, so if you've got somebody to snuggle up with, keep them warm. Sunday, February 15th, daytime high of -3, going to feel closer to -11. And then starting off next week, Monday, February 16th, daytime high of 1, but we've got cloudy and cool conditions. It's actually going to feel closer to -6 when all is said and done. This is your City of Kingston traffic report for the week. Kingston's overnight winter parking ban is in effect for the months of January and February, which prohibits any and all overnight street parking between the hours of 12 a.m. and 7 a.m. Restrictions will loosen on March 1st. From that point on, for the rest of March, overnight street parking is only banned if the weather conditions require it. And with no relevant road closures to report, that's it for your City of Kingston traffic report for this week.
Thank you, Jesse. Now back to more local news. Kingstonians who have not yet had a chance to explore the illuminated forest, say hi to KCFF mascot Conrad the Raccoon, lace up their skates, or toast some marshmallows yet this winter are in luck. The Downtown Kingston BIA has announced the extension of the Spirit of Winter Festival until the end of the month. While the second annual winter celebration set up in Springer Market Square was originally scheduled to end on February 16th, due to overwhelming popularity, the event will now run through February 28. In an interview about the launch of the festival earlier this month, Downtown Kingston events manager Sandy Griffiths shared that the event's new addition this year, the Snow Dome Village, was especially popular, with spots selling out in record time.
But because we've had such a phenomenal response to the snow domes already, we are actually extending the whole festival through the end of February. So because some of the days for the snow domes have already sold out.
Visitors can reserve the heated dome set up by City Hall for a cozy hang and order treats and hot beverages from local downtown businesses. The success of the Snow Dome Village was a large contributing factor in the decision to extend the event. A portion of the proceeds from Snow Dome Village fund the BIA's Welcoming Streets program, which engages with individuals experiencing homelessness, addiction, and mental health difficulties, connecting them with essential resources and services. The revenue also helps sustain the BIA's free summer programming, including Kingston Buskers Rendezvous, Movies in the Square, and Salsa in the Square. Jan McDonald, the BIA's director of events, said in a recent release, quote, "We're absolutely delighted by the community's response to Spirit of Winter Enchanted. Extending the event not only gives more people a chance to experience the magic, but also amplifies our ability to support our outreach and events programming that strengthen our downtown community year-round," end quote. Once again, you can catch Spirit of Winter Enchanted until the end of the month in Springer Market Square. A unique collaboration between two Kingston cultural organizations is bringing medical history and classic horror cinema together on the big screen. For the first time, the Canadian Museum of Healthcare is partnering with the Cinema Society of Kingston on a 3-week film series at the Screening Room,
entitled The Doctor Is In, examining how medicine and anxiety surrounding it have been portrayed in horror films over time. The films being screened are X, the Man with the X-Ray Eyes, The Face of Another, and Dr. Jekyll and Sister Hyde. Each Sunday afternoon for the rest of February, the screenings will be introduced by the museum's curator, Rowena McGowan, alongside film scholar Dr. Dan Venna, with historical context and artifacts from the museum's collection. I spoke with Rowena McGowan about the partnership and what audiences can expect from the series. Looking at the event, nothing could make more sense, but I was wondering how this kind of came together. What sparked the idea for this collaboration?
So what happened was last year I went to a screening at the screening room, which was it was Arsenic and Old Lace. And Queen's Special Collections did a announcement beforehand, like a little presentation on arsenic in their collection, which was really interesting. And I kind of looked at that and went, oh, I want to get in there. So the original idea was just to do one screening and do just a medically related film and talk about the history. And then the museum hosts an annual symposium every year. This year, it's going to be on March 12th, if anyone is interested. And it is all about health humanities and teaching with and about health humanities. And last year, I met Dr. Dan Venna, who is a film scholar at Queen's and is very knowledgeable and extremely generous with his time. So we got chatting and I pitched like, you know about film, you're interested in horror film, medicine pops up all the time in horror film, do you want to maybe do a showing together? And he said, that's a really cool idea, let's do a whole series. So that's kind of what the idea came from. And then we pitched it. He had a contact at the Cinema Society of Kingston, so we pitched it there. They were really interested and it kind of grew up from there.
Awesome. And you kind of got into it there, but why the horror genre?
I think medicine is really interesting because it is meant to be something that helps. Like fundamentally, medicine and healthcare are supposed to be for healing. They are supposed to make people better. But of course, there have been issues with medicine throughout history, both in terms of treatments that don't work, that we didn't necessarily always understand didn't work, in terms of the sort of patient experiences, how patients were treated. Our current model of medical ethics is very recent. So there are a lot of genuine issues with healthcare and with medicine and things that frighten people. And then that becomes really interesting because you have these sort of grounded real world thoughts and anxieties that then get hyperbolized in cinema. There's so many sort of classic horror tropes that are based in medicine, like the scary doctor, the scary dentist, the scary psychiatric institution. They're just so tied together. So that was really the foundation of the series, was we didn't just want to talk about scary thing, medical things in movies. What we wanted to investigate was, well, where does that come from? And how do real world ideas then become these very over the top, exaggerated horror tropes?
Mm-hmm, for sure. And what was kind of the process of narrowing down the movies you're going to pick? So you've picked three, but I imagine that there were a lot on the table when you guys started talking about this.
Yeah, there were a lot of movies. I think we had a couple of criteria. We're doing this for the first time. So one of our criteria was we did not want to show anything that was too intense. These are horror movies. There is going to be violence and sexuality and death because they're horror movies. But we didn't want to do anything that was extremely over the top violent, extremely over the top on any of those other subjects. So that was sort of one criteria, was we wanted to kind of make it accessible for a more general audience. We also wanted to cover as many topics as we could. One can easily do an entire series on scary dentists or scary psychiatric institutions, but really we wanted to cover within as much as we could within a three film series, as many different ideas as we could. So that was another thing. And finally, we were really kind of discussing stuff that on Dan's side, movies that he found compelling, and on my side, the kinds of histories that I thought would be well supported with artifacts from the museum's collection, and that I thought would be easy and interesting to talk about. Because the other thing is, it's not going to be a very long introduction. It's not a class. I'm not going to talk at anyone for an hour. So it had to be something that we could give a grounding in fairly quickly and easily. It couldn't be a hyper complex topic. So things like, for example, our first movie, it will be about X-rays and the history of X-rays, which is something that certainly there is a lot of info about, but you can summarize kind of the main points in this intro to the movie and give people enough information that then they can hopefully go into the film and see the connections that we're drawing. So those were sort of the three main ideas we were playing with.
And without giving away too much, like you said, you and Dr. Vina are going to be kind of introducing these films and the kind of cultural and historical context. What kind of themes will we be exploring during this event?
So the way we have it structured is that I will be talking about the medical history, and I will be doing it with artifacts from the museum's collection. So everyone who attends can come see some artifacts and they can touch some of them. Not all of them, but some of them are from our education collection. So, for example, our very first showing, February 8th at 4 p.m., they're all at 4, is going to be X, the man with the X-ray eyes. So I am going to be talking about the history of X-rays. Dan is going to be giving more of a sort of cultural understanding of what is going on when this movie is being made. So I believe for X, the man with the X-ray eyes, he'll be talking about things like science fiction and its relation to horror, ideas about sort of science and religion and all those kinds of things. So we're hoping to kind of bring them together, that idea of this broader medical history, and also what is going on in society at basically exactly when this movie is being made. That's sort of how we're trying to link each other together.
And coming from the Museum of Healthcare side, I was wondering if you could speak to the importance of kind of exploring these darker themes in medical history.
The thing about medical history is if you are being honest about it, you can't not explore the darker side of it, because a lot of medical history is really difficult and you're really hiding a big chunk of it if you're not talking about some of the difficult things that medical professionals have done, the way our understandings of medical ethics have changed over time, the way our understandings of how to heal have changed over time. I mean, bloodletting was done for such a long time, and of course we still do it, but in a very restricted sense, whereas for a long time, we really thought that was effective healing and we were doing a lot of it. So you can't not talk about it. And you can't not talk about it in the sense that, of course, people are coming in with their own experiences, their own interactions with the healthcare system. I have always said that the interesting thing about working at this museum is that your relationship with healthcare can change on a dime depending on your experiences, for good or for ill. I mean, I broke a bone once when I was working at the Canadian Museum of Healthcare, and that was a rough month. There were certain artifacts like I couldn't look at while I was recovering. And I think in terms of this horror movie series, people are interested in the macabre. And this was a way to interact with that, but still talk about that grounded history, which I think is really, really important, and provide perspective. These ideas are already out there. We already have these pop culture ideas. So a lot of it was, the ideas exist. Where did they come from? We can't make them not exist. So let's talk about them.
And you are bringing some artifacts in. You don't have to give it all away, but I was wondering if you could tell us a little bit about that.
So we will not be, unfortunately, I will not be bringing anything particularly large because I do have to carry it. And it has to be things that can be safely transported. But at every showing, I will be bringing artifacts related to the subject. I find artifacts are a really powerful way to ground things, to provide that perspective, which is what museums are all about. That's not unique to us. The entire point of museums is that we have the stuff. And when you can see something, it really gives you that understanding that I think you can't get from just talking about something, just seeing how big something is, what materials it's made out of. I always give the example of, this is certainly not traveling with me because it's very big, but we have an iron lung in our museum. It's a beautiful piece. I encourage everyone to come see it. But I find when I'm giving a tour that iron lung is so powerful, because even if people are really interested and they love the tour, they love what I'm talking about, they're still seeing it at a distance. When I get questions, they are very distance questions. People are asking, oh, what date was this? That kind of thing. And when we get to the iron lung, the questions change. And you start to get questions like, was it uncomfortable to be in the iron lung? How long were you in the iron lung? How do you go to the bathroom in the iron lung? And you can see that shift in people's thinking, that suddenly they are picturing themselves in the iron lung. I think that's a really important aspect of museum work, is that idea of objects as this physical, tangible thing that can connect you with the past.
In this case, with the films as well, I suppose.
With the films as well, yes. Mm-hmm.
And what are you hoping audiences take away from this event?
I think the Canadian Museum of Healthcare, what we're really all about is that idea of perspective. So I hope they have a wonderful time, first of all. This is designed to be fun, so I hope they just enjoy themselves and think it was a nice time out, and hopefully that they learned something. But really, what we're interested in is getting people to understand that history, understand the idea that things like films are coming from specific ideas, specific anxieties, that they are always kind of a reflection of what is going on in society at the time. So hopefully they will know a little bit more medical history. Hopefully they will have a little bit of a better understanding of where these particular films are coming from. And hopefully they can maybe start to think about modern films and where those ideas are coming from and what ideas are being sort of dramatized and exaggerated in modern horror, because of course we still do that even today.
Awesome. And how can folks attend?
Absolutely. So it will be at the screening room. It will be February 8th, February 15th, and February 22nd at 4 o'clock. Tickets will be available at the screening room. They are $10, all in, I believe, tax included.
That was Rowena McGowan, curator at the Canadian Museum of Healthcare. The three-week series The Doctor Is In runs Sundays at 4 p.m. from February 8th to 22nd at the screening room on Princess Street. February 8th will be X, the man with the X-ray eyes. The 15th will be The Face of Another, and the 22nd will be Dr. Jekyll and Sister Hyde. That is all things current in Kingston for this week. Thank you for listening to CFRC's news programming, brought to you by the generous support of the Community Radio Fund of Canada, under the Local Journalism Initiative, Queen's University Career Services, and the Screening Room at screeningroomkingston.com. To listen on the go and hear more from some of our guests, head to our podcast network at podcast.cfrc.ca. Be sure to stay tuned for more CFRC programming coming up next.
Friday evenings at 6 p.m. here on CFRC, listen to Saltwater Music, a show covering all musical genres from the East Coast of Canada. Celtic, of course, but also rock, jazz, blues, folk, and a lot more. I'm your host, Rob Carnell. Tune in to Saltwater Music Friday evening from 6 to 8 here on CFRC 101.9 FM. Or you can catch us on the web at www.cfrc.ca. And for our listeners out east, that's 7 p.m. Atlantic and 7:30 Newfoundland.
Coming up now on this week's Release Radar, in partnership with the Kingston Music Office, we're pleased to present a selection from Juno-nominated Maple Blues Award-winning local artist Miss Emily's new album, The Medicine, released on November 7th. Produced by Grammy winner Colin Linden, the album blends soul, blues, and roots with an all-star lineup, including players from Bob Dylan and Keb Moe's bands. Pairing her thunderous voice with songs of truth and resilience, Miss Emily channels two decades of raw experience into music that heals and uplifts. Want to be highlighted next time? Complete the Release Radar submission form on the Kingston Music Office website or via visit kingston.music on the Instagram. In the meantime, stream The Medicine by Miss Emily on your favorite platforms and enjoy a selection from it called Stand Together, Band Together. Here with us now on CFRC 101.9 FM.
load. It takes more than one hand to build this road. Stand together, band together, keeping this in mind. You can talk it up until you're out of time. It takes more than one man to stop that climb. Stand together, band together, every child you know. Stronger than
Coming up now on this week's Release Radar, in partnership with the Kingston Music Office, we're pleased to present a selection from Summer's End Society alum Dupel, Wilhound, and Cacao's new joint collaborative EP, Groove Inc. This groovy new release marks a distinctively heavy sound through hard-hitting drums produced by Wilhound, composition, production, and synth work from Cacao, and the provocatively twisting lyrical prowess of Jacques Dupel. Want to be highlighted next time? Complete the Release Radar submission form on the Kingston Music Office website or via visit Kingston.music on Instagram. In the meantime, stream Groove Inc. by Dupel, Wilhound, and Cacao now on your favorite platforms and enjoy a selection from it here called Emma Stone Fine with us right now here on CFRC 101.9 FM.
Extra in and different one is what you like, ayy. show that helps you relax and unwind after a busy day. Ah! Raccoon Radio Show with Gino Alash. Hard rock and heavy metal. Every Tuesday from 8 to 10.